Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wampler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hey, Margaret. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing okay. And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. Oliver, we've all, I believe, shifted solidly into spring-summer wear.
Yes, you have a very nice orange, and I can't tell in this color of the light now. What I think is that teal pants?
Is it a pale blue?
Pale blue, yes.
It's beachy.
It is very beachy.
Oliver is going entirely sockless.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Coming up in this week's show, we're going to be talking about divorce in popular culture. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Oliver Wang. What are you all about this week?
So there was a story that came out in California Sunday Magazine, I think this past week, about this new service called Crowds on Demand. And for about somewhere, there's peak pricing here, but you can hire people for any kind of crowd, you know, needed event for somewhere between $10 to $15 an hour. And so the person who reports on it, and I think it's actually the founder of Found Magazine is the person who reports on it, he ends up, you know, participating in one of these events where he's paid to be basically part of this paparazzi crowd that's been hired to welcome life coaches into some life coach convention. And so they're there to sort of cheer on everyone and pretend that these life coaches are rock stars. And so the reporter delves into the service that's offered by this. And so you can hire people to, I mean, basically any kind for political events, for pop culture events. One of the most, I thought, incredible examples was this member of some kind of European royalty, minor European royalty, hired people because her security detail didn't really believe that she was all that important. So she hired people to basically come up to her at random places, not to like attack or anything, but to sort of like ask for an autograph or to be excited to see her to make her security detail believe that she was actually important.
Paid audience is not new to Los Angeles. We've had that for TV shows for some time, but there is something interesting about this need growing.
Right. And the fact that you can now, I mean, this is very much part of like the gig share economy, is that you can hire people to do whatever you need them for. And so another really interesting example in the story was there was a Masons meeting, right? I thought these things were supposed to be like top secret, but there was a Masons meeting. And there was a vote taken in by the Masons that had sort of anti-LGBT qualities to it. And so a pissed off Mason member hired the service to bring out a fake news reporting group to interrogate people coming into the Masons meeting about what did they think about this legislation.
Is this legal?
Yes.
It's fascinating.
Right. I mean, you can basically create – I mean, you're just bringing together a group. Normally, activists do it by convincing people that this is something that's important. This – company does it by paying people to show up and do it for you.
If you can hire people to go get signatures for you outside of Walgreens,
right,
why shouldn't you be able to do
right
this?
I mean, yes.
Does this explain Trump's phenomenon?
No. Sadly, his is fairly organic. But if you wanted to have a protest group to protest Trump, and you're not convinced that you could gather enough people organically, you could hire this guy to then produce, you know, however, you know, if you got like George Soros money, you can basically hire, you know, 1,000 people to come out and do a counter-protest.
Luckily, there are enough human beings with uteruses who want to keep control of them that outrage against Trump will probably also be groundswell.
It's just a fantastic article. So again, it's in California Sunday Magazine, and it's called, I think, maybe Move the Crowd or Crowd Control or something like that.
And it's Davey Rothbart,
yes,
right?
Yes. He reported on it.
Yeah.
Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Oh, so April Fool's is on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, companies really can't ever really pull it together in the way that they hope that it would land. Because they act like fools so many other days of the year, it doesn't really matter on April Fool's.
But there's something so fun about the fact that, like, this has become the holiday that, like, corporations get in on and try to prove that they're cool.
Well, in theory,
so sad. They've ruined it.
Super Bowl, I think, has lost its – I think we talked about it. It's lost its luster as being the premier – time period to sort of push yourself out there and be the coolest kid on the block. So now it's April Fool's. And out of all the really rather pathetic efforts that were and attempts that were made by companies, Hamburger Helper cleared the fucking
What did they do? What did they do?
They put a fucking mixtape out with 5 tracks on the motherfucker. All right?
And a good mixtape.
And a good mixtape.
Okay. How what many
was,
of them?
Shit was lit.
Are there recipes in the songs?
No. Shit. I'm so angry. I'm so excited about the shit.
So what was it?
Hit the mic. It was basically they got I researched this heavily because I wanted to talk about this with so much gusto. It's been the talk of my clique. Basically, Hamburger Helper has an in-house agency, and they talked amongst themselves and said, listen, we know our demographic. It's guys who are in dorm rooms, and then it's moms. So overwhelmingly on Twitter, Hamburger Helper is brought up a lot by this specific urban demographic.
Yeah.
And we also talk about hip hop. So people were daring, they said people were daring them for months, like, if you're so into hip hop, come with it. And they literally started in last fall working on this mixtape with Minneapolis musicians, paid them to do tracks, didn't really give them much control. The directive was talk about Hamburger Helper and what it means to your life. And they wrote tracks.
This is delicious.
It's amazing. It's one of
the best casserole I could possibly have on April Fool's.
There's something so interesting about the fact that these very, very hokey brands that are a part of.
I would never eat the shit myself.
But everybody did as a kid,
yes,
right?
We've all eaten and delighted in Hamburger Helper. But that these hokey brands that are affiliated with these gigantic, like, multinational corporations, periodically, they are the ones who somehow manage to, like, thread the needle perfectly. My friend Julia Bensfield Luce worked for Velveeta. She was running Velveeta's Facebook, like, online.
Presence,
and she was a comic with this, like, ridiculous, like, she's a pothead now, she's a mom, but
right.
Like, she was like a pothead and just these, like, ridiculous surreal uses of Velveeta, and people started falling in love with it because it's fucking Velveeta.
Yeah,
isn't part of the reason why it works with something like Hamburger Helper is specifically because we don't expect Hamburger Helper to come with some fire mixtape,
and it's inherently absurd.
Yeah,
it's inherently absurd, but I think the reason why it worked is because it was you could actually tell that they made a concerted effort.
Oh, it was done well.
Can we hear the first track?
I have one here called Feed the Streets.
Yes, that's the number one. That's the hottest shit right now. It's better than The Life of Pablo.
And another one.
And another one.
I've been in the kitchen, whipping. I've been chefing, mixing with my left hand. Water whipping in the pouring. Yo, I'm beefing, I'm a savage.
There's also something so interesting about self-awareness by brands. There's that lovely moment from American Crime Story where the black and white jurors are arguing about
Martin versus Seinfeld.
Well, and Marshalls versus Target. And there's something wonderful about a brand understanding, like, no, we have a demographic, and, like, just embracing it.
It's, you know, I'll just say this. April Fool's Day is a hard day to get right because we're all so fucking jaded.
Yeah.
So anything you do, I'm like, eh. Like, Gwen Stefani tweeted a sonogram photo, and I was like, girl, you didn't even think about this.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go and make this much effort, you really have to know your brand. And they won. It's gotten over 466 million impressions. That's very effective marketing. There's way more awareness about Hamburger Helper than there has ever been in the last 36 years I've been on Earth.
Shake and Bake is jealous out
jealous,
there.
So right. Jealous.
I've heard that it helps hamburger make a great meal.
I'm really hungry for, like, onion rings too now.
Yeah.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about AWP, which is the conference of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. And it's basically when 12,000 hungry, thirsty, desperate, crazed, inspired, overwhelmed writers descend on LA Convention Center one time a year. And it actually roves around each year. Last year it was in Minneapolis. Next year it's going to be in DC, but this year it was in LA. And it's kind of a spectacular check-in with the industry in terms of, for one thing, going into this AWP, there were some interesting controversies. There was a lot of anger from certain people about there not being enough panels dedicated to disability. Mm. There was another controversy around Vanessa Place, who is one of the people who was on the programming committee, who caught a lot of flack last year for – she's a conceptual poet, and she caught a lot of flack for having this Twitter account where she just would tweet text from Gone with the Wind. Like kind of
– I remember this.
Yes,
yeah.
Like kind of the most like racist lines from Gone with the Wind. It was just kind of coming out of this Twitter feed, and people got angry about it. And she issued an apology that was kind of like, sorry, not sorry. So – there was a lot of kind of heat coming into this one around, you know, what are we going to be talking about? Who's going to call out the gatekeepers? Claudia Rankine, who is a poet who has really just her profile is shot up with this book that she wrote called Citizen. She was the keynote speaker, and people were – I didn't get to catch it myself, but people were absolutely blown away by her speech. I've seen her speak before at the end of BinderCon.
She was trending on Twitter.
Yeah. And she basically was doing a good old call out, just mm-hmm. saying to people, you know, you're the gatekeepers, you're the editors, it's not on people of color to be letting in more people of color in the industry. It's on everyone. Right. This is now a duty for all of us. So that was really striking too. Like as a weekend, it's totally overwhelming and crazy because you're just in this huge convention center with, you know, there's all this kind of, it's an easy trigger for compare and despair, you know, like you're all walking around with name tags and people kind of like check your name tag and see if you're important enough to talk to you kind of thing. Yeah, which is kind of like
so a little much. Sounds to me like a slightly less snooty and pretentious MLA conference. Is that sort of on par?
I think that sounds about right.
Okay. A little looser.
What's the MLA conference?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
like
the Modern Language Association, which is where all the English professors go to. So yeah. This sounds like kind of similar, just not nearly as black outfit as maybe MLA. Maybe there's a lot of black outfits at AWP, though. I don't know.
There's some colors.
Okay. So when you're dealing with pretty solitary discipline like writing, what do things get like once you guys get to your con? Like, what's the feel?
The orgy dome is incredible.
I mean, there's a lot of offsite drinking. Uh-huh. There's definitely people meeting for lunches with friends they haven't seen. I mean, it does also function as this like reunion space. A lot of people don't see each other except for that one time a year at AWP. Yeah. So it has a really sweet feeling in that way. But it also, I think, definitely makes insecurities rise up in people. For instance, there was this Twitter feed that started right at during the Ooh. Conference called the Conference Goer. And it was this person that was just tweeting about how lousy he or she felt just walking around AWP. And it kind of like it caught on with a lot of people because this person was like suicidal basically in these tweets, and everyone was concerned and tweeting poems at her or him. And yeah, so I mean, it has this like there's the light and the dark, you know what I mean? Like there's networking and it's fun and reunions, and then there's people just feeling shabby and crappy about themselves.
Former guest host Karen Kilgariff has an amazing lyric in one of her songs. It is, if someone asks me again what I've been working on, I may never stop crying. And I feel like anyone in gig-based work, or I think any sort of creative work, there is that feeling that the minute somebody asks you what you're working on, it's a reminder of how not important you are.
Yeah, it has this weird thing of being simultaneously encouraging to see this huge convention center filled up with people who are doing the same thing as you. And then also it's like, oh no, here are all these people doing exactly the same thing as me.
This week, let me give a brief prologue before my all about. It can get really annoying when we talk about things that our friends are doing, or if it becomes too much of a mutual admiration society within the groups of people who I work with or whatever. But this week I am talking about a work by a dude who exists on the Drag Mother podcast of this podcast. Glenn Weldon from Pop Culture Happy Hour released his book, The Cape Crusade, and that's what I'm all about this week. It is a like authoritative history of Batman, and in this, in these weeks when we are getting a, you know, Ben Affleck's take on the Batman. If you are looking for something a little bit stronger or purer, go to Glenn's book. It is a really fascinating book that both makes the argument that I'd never thought of before, that Batman, unlike other superheroes, is an important character in Western literature and one that has been reinterpreted and deserves to be reinterpreted. And along the way, he also talks about the way that the evolution of Batman has echoed the evolution of pop culture, you know, going deeply campy for a while, then going super, super dark in the 90s. And he sort of charts the evolution of nerd culture and its relationship to having its icons be reinterpreted and, you know, the ways that nerds have grown up and the way that nerd icons have grown up. It is a fascinating, fascinating book that Glenn does a astounding job of making really, really fun. He has a really campy, campy, fun use of footnotes that I cannot recommend enough. Like, he'll make a joke in the text and then explain it in a footnote. He just does a great job of taking 70 years of history of a visual medium and turning it into text through astoundingly evocative language, through really, really sharp, funny jokes. I can't recommend the book enough.
I mean, I'm just Batmaned out, but I'm really happy for him.
Has anyone here actually none of us have seen Batman versus Superman, have we?
I have not.
Everybody shit on it enough for me not to want to go enjoy it.
Yeah. I'm actually curious at this point. I'm curious. Because I've also read certain people who, like, loved it.
Yeah, but now it's like, it's been so much, you know how it's just like you ruined it. You know, like, it's like an eggshell and a
don't
great
you want to support your boy?
I love the fucking
he's
shit
out there
of him.
Crying about this stuff.
Glenn's argument is essentially, like, we've had too much of brooding Batman. Like,
yes.
Like, brooding Batman, like,
it's become a bit of a cliche. It was really fresh at a certain point.
Yes, in the 90s when Dark Knight Rises happened, what was
Christian Bale?
No. I'm talking about when it happened in the comic books. Like, that was a new, fresh, sort of like deeper take on superheroes. But, you know, there are decades of delightful Adam Westy sort of like play with this weird guy in tights who's hanging around. And also, I mean, one of the things that's important about Glenn's book is that, like, there's something super gay about Batman.
There
like,
is.
Batman is this wealthy dude with a youthful ward who hangs out in his house all of the time and was scarred by his childhood. And, like, Glenn goes there and sort of, like, pulls apart the way that there's something really fun about exploring that world and this rich guy who's, you know.
But we tried that. We tried to have that Batman with Batman and Robin, and everybody. I don't know if it's Joel Schumacher's.
That's a lot to do with it.
Or Clooney, or what the.
Or is it an audience full of, like, fanboy nerds who weren't willing to take anything remotely fun associated
with
their beloved Batman? Because let me say of Batman and Robin, every motherfucking line in that movie is a one-liner.
Camp as fuck. It's the campiest of the camp.
Take two of these and call me in the morning. Like, you know, like, it's delightful. What were you going to say, Margaret?
Oh, I was going to ask you if he spends time examining the relationship between Batman and Robin. Like, what does he think is going on there for real?
Oh, I mean, like, Glenn really, really, like, digs into the fact that, like, there is a weird, like, gay fantasy going on here that is sort of an interesting element of, like, you know, male adolescent interests.
No, they should just have Tim Robin come back. That should be the case, to
All
be
right.
honest.
You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about divorce in pop culture right after this.
Hi, this is Sheila from Helsingborg, Sweden. And I listen to Bullseye because they're less like interviews and more like great conversations.
Jesse is so well-researched and so articulate and so passionate about the subjects that he interviews.
You can really just feel a kinship.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to musician Tao Wen and director Lance Bangs on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And this week, Drew Barrymore announced that she was breaking up with her third husband, Will Koppelman, after 4 years of marriage. And as a delightful Gen X icon ends her third marriage, a nice, tasteful marriage to, like, a wealthy Jew. That's what a third marriage should be. We wanted to talk about divorce and pop culture and really the two interesting aspects of it. Divorce as an event in the lives of real-life pop culture icons and the way that that gives us a different insight into them, and also the way that divorce comes up in pop culture. Like, so frequently pop culture can be focused on, you know, love and romance and the side of things where you are figuring out who you're going to end up with. And those times that we step back and ask, who are you not going to end up with, can create some pretty amazing works. Guys, I think that one of the main reasons that divorce in pop culture, in real life pop culture, is fascinating is because it gives us a look behind the veil of privacy that you normally have in a couple. Mm. That I always go back to, like, when Sherry Shepherd got divorced, we learned exactly how much Sherry Shepherd made because, like, you know,
Steven Spielberg,
what her income was. Yeah, like that you have these fascinating looks into what was his first wife's name?
Amy Irving.
Amy Irving going on and on about how his wife, or about how his mom, I'm sorry, his mom wife, how Steven Spielberg's mom hated her because she wasn't Jewish enough. Mm-hmm. And that led to a gigantic fight and then her getting $80 million or something. Yes.
Yeah. It's always been interesting because divorces have like boosted the economy for tabloids for sure. Whenever someone's about to get a divorce, there's a divorce economy. Like, you have to sort of break down, like, who gets what. It's never about the kids. It's never about the careers. It's always about who's going to get the house, or who's going to get the car, or what led up to this.
Well, it's interestingly the other side of this marriage economy and having celebrity marriage be so important.
Sure.
My friend Heather is good friends with Kris Jenner.
Right.
And, you know, like, Kim Kardashian openly was saying, I don't think I want to get married, a week before she got married to Chris Humphries.
Right.
But by that point in time, Chris had to be like, honey, we've already sold the rights to this.
Right.
And she had to get married, and then she had to have exactly the splashy divorce that you would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, they literally suffered through those, 72 days?
Yeah.
They suffered. I watched every single day of that, and I was like, good gracious, this is going to completely sink them. And then what happens? Kanye. Divorce has never been more sexy now, because now everybody's Blair Burke, the top divorce attorney, she's basically said after the Oscars, there's going to be even more divorces than the ones you've already heard about, which I thought was really weird for a divorce attorney to say. But now we come to Drew.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about divorce in Hollywood in particular is that they've been divorcing for like much longer and at a higher frequency than the regular American populace has. And I feel like all of us as children of the 80s, I'm sure you guys remember, just like every week it felt like Elizabeth Taylor was divorcing somebody.
Exactly.
Yes. And that's like the primary way I grew up thinking about her. And in a lot of ways, I think Drew Barrymore is kind of like a Gen X Elizabeth Taylor, you know, and as far as her divorce kind of profile goes, and her relationships go.
I was looking at her relationships, and they really are, I think, each and every one of them a classic choice. First husband, useless bartender. Second husband, Tom Green, like a celebrity of like both at that time kind of equal caliber, but somebody who is like so of the moment in that same way that like you know, Goldie Hawn being married to that Hudson guy is like, you know, who the fuck was that? And then, you know, I really do think your third husband should be wealthy Jew, investment banker possibly, maybe like a French gynecologist.
French gynecologist. You can see her trying to make this decision of being, of like, I'm going to be a grown up in this one. I'm going to make a good, solid pick.
Second, third husband, you marry an agent. You marry, you know, like a guy who's probably got his shit together. And then you turn around and what do you know? He's fucking around on you too.
Mm-hmm.
Oliver.
Yes.
Have our celebrities gotten too good at tastefully separating? Mm. Living in a world of conscious uncoupling, do we not get the splash, the fireworks that we got, you know, from Liz Taylor, you know, leaving Richard Burton and him buying her the biggest diamond on the planet to try to get her back?
I'm trying to think of the most recent divorce debacle. And I think that a lot of the times when you read about celebrities divorcing, it's always, I mean, number one, the flow of information, I think, is very highly controlled because people don't want, you know, people getting insights into their assets, let alone some of the more unsavory personal elements. And people always want to present like a very good, you know, front to it. And I was thinking before about what Winter was saying in terms of the ways in which tabloids have caked on reporting on this. And I mean, the fact that like Jen and Brad's divorce is still news today. And it's been, how many years has that been? 10, 15 at this point? But
it was a perfect divorce.
It was. And it wasn't, and it didn't seem acrimonious in I mean, I think there was a lot of ways in which people wanted to make more of it than it actually was. But the actual details of it feel really.
Okay. I never really thought about it before, but it really is a perfect echo of Debbie Reynolds, Liz Taylor, and Eddie Fisher that you had like.
The triangle.
Yeah, that you had Debbie Reynolds as this, like, I mean, the Jen Aniston of the situation, like a nice, good girl that we all liked and every boy thought was dreamy. Eddie Fisher, a guy, and then sort of like, and then sort of.
She referenced it herself, or Debbie Reynolds referenced it.
Did she?
Yes, she made it. She said that what happened to them is what happened to me.
And, like, I do think that so speaks to a story we want to see and we want to hear.
But it's raggedy now because they're raggedy.
But look at your boy
Ben.
Well,
everybody's remarried in that situation too and yeah. Seemingly fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, look at the most recent divorce that's sort of made some news in the last couple of weeks was, you know, finally Ben and Jennifer.
Finally being the operative word.
Well,
finally.
But Your wishful thing, your hope springs eternal with
right,
you. Here. I love
right.
that.
And I mean, the difficult thing about a marriage like that is that it really is one of those things that feels structured to be a long-term forever. Like they're both big celebrities, but she's so nice and fine and I think boring as fuck. But like it really was one of those things that felt like Spielberg and Kate Capshaw were like, that can go.
But I mean, even their divorce, though, it's just very respectful. No one wants to pop shit about anybody else. And there's, a very powerful control of information about how much stuff gets leaked out. So in the end, I think in a lot of ways, and this goes back to your initial point, Guy, I think these uncouplings sort of follow the same kind of gentleness as the couplings themselves, is that when people get together, it's like, oh, isn't that nice? These two people that we like and are famous are together now. And when they fall apart, it's like, oh, isn't it nice how they're falling apart?
Gwen Stefani is a great example of this. Gwen Stefani goes on and leaves Gavin, and he's cheated with the nanny. And now the nanny is miraculously pregnant. We don't know. No one knows anything. That, to me, is one of the sloppier effects of divorcing. Everything that's happened since the announcement, I was surprised by the announcement, and everything since, I'm not surprised by it. It's all just too little too orchestrated. And I actually prefer people to be a little bit more like loosey-goosey with the whole thing. Like Gwyneth Paltrow, the reason why it worked for her is because that's the brand she's been selling for the last 10, 15 years. And they never, ever made the only time you ever saw Discord, because they weren't putting their shit out there, is when she was like annoyingly twisting that water open at the Golden Globes table as they cut to commercial. That's a gift that keeps giving us life. But there's something about the... Not because I'm in love with Ben Affleck. There's something about the Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner split that has been designed to give her economy.
Right.
And has been and was situated so he wouldn't have to deal with as much bullshit during the press tour.
What do you mean by give her economy?
She's basically has always asserted that she put her career on hold because his career was important to him and he had to write and direct and her kids were important to them and she was holding on to the family, the sanctity of the family. So she didn't really get to have the career that she thought she deserved or that she wanted to focus on because she had a family. And now she's like, I got to work. She started this conversation a year ago. I got to get back out there and I got to work. And so now he set it up so she can have the ability to work and not be tainted.
I was going to say with Gwyneth Paltrow and the conscious uncoupling thing is that I think she's also echoing the fact that as a culture, we've all gotten better about divorce, that they aren't as sloppy and horrific as they used to be, like in the Kramer versus Kramer kind of idea of divorce. Well, you know, like she was able to say, like, we've got two kids. We still respect each other. We're just going to now go our separate ways in a peaceful way. And I think that's actually was really, I thought that was a beautiful thing.
As we segue from talking about real life celebrity divorces to media about divorces, like the clear turning point is Nora Ephron's book from the 70s, Heartburn, where she took the real unfolding story of her own divorce from Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein. And within a year, like with a child in her belly and a 2-year-old on her arm, turned the most personal story she had into a best-selling book that also completely torched her husband. And Winner, last week you talked about Everything's Copy, the new HBO documentary that her son made about her life. And what is fascinating about that documentary is the way that everybody in that, they're talking about a dead woman that they love, but have to admit that her turning that story into something public desperately affected, like, yeah, she got on top of the story and she made it her own, but it also meant that her children always had that as a barrier between them and their father. And it was really, there was something so sweet and hard to watching Carl Bernstein talk to his son about the fact that that book made him resent him.
It was fucking beautiful, to be honest. Honestly, like, I just have bowed down to her. The fact that she was going around telling everybody who Deep Throat was and they didn't fucking believe her. That was just like, it was sounds like something that would happen to me.
That book is so good because it really talks about a
Mark
felt. It talks about a set of emotions that you don't normally hear discussed. And I think because it is a distinctly feminine perspective, it opens up with he's fucking someone else and ends at I don't love him anymore. And the process that it takes to stop loving someone and stop having somebody's like opinion and affection affect you is heart-wrenching. I think it is a really, really amazing work, but is reflective of this 1970s burn everything down approach to divorces that you get in Kramer versus Kramer or Irreconcilable Differences, which is the story of it is like a light fictionalization of Peter Bogdanovich
breaking up with Polly Platt.
Bringing up with Polly Platt and really was sort of her.
And Sybil Shepherd was the Sharon Stone character.
Was the Sharon Stone character, but it really is Polly Platt pulling out a knife and stabbing at her husband from beyond.
Yeah, and the movie didn't do that well, but the movie was completely effective for talking to it. They used Drew Barrymore, of course, because every little girl that was, I was just a couple years shy of her. So we all looked up to her because she was doing the work for us. She was dealing with the adults and saying what we had to say, our spokesperson. But that movie was so effective in showing just how it was very Hollywood, but it showed how divorce really affects a child and the relationship she has, like losing respect for her father and then losing respect for her mother. That was one of like the best.
And I watched a scene from it where her dad is talking to her and really confiding in her. And she says, I'm tired of being your best friend.
Yeah.
And I think that's something else that kids of divorce really know about is that their parents lose the spouse that they used to talk to all the time about their work problems and blah, 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 blah. And so you might be this 11-year-old kid who's fielding these kind of mature conflict issues in your parents' work life or whatever.
Oliver, what is your favorite pop culture representation of divorce?
I was thinking about this before, but the problem is the ones that come to mind are all the ones that begin with a pair of divorced parents who then get reconciled by the end because that's the grand fairy tale. And really the very first film that came to mind for that, I mean, there's a whole genre, but it's really the remake of Parent Trap, which was sort of like, Lindsay's sort of big coming out film when she was, I don't know, 10 or 11 at the time. I mean, partly because when you cast Dennis Quaid, across from Natasha Richardson, that's a really appealing couple.
Well, famously, a Yale professor wrote a book on the comedies of remarriage from the 30s and 40s, screwball comedies like Philadelphia Story and His Girl Friday, that are about a couple, possibly married, possibly not, who get back together. And it really is the best romance because it's a romance of people who already know each other and already know why to hate each other but have already fallen in love. And I think there is real appeal in dealing with that, because there is also sort of like an equality of bargaining power in these couples. The women seem a little bit more sophisticated because they're not a naive girl in the first blush of love. There's somebody who's been around the horn.
Right.
It's interesting that you bring that up, Guy, because War of the Roses completely shows the love in the beginning, like how they fall desperately, madly in love. And it literally, that's why I love this movie so much, because it shows the journey from love to lust, to hate, and just despising someone and then hate.
And how they manipulate each other,
yeah.
You know, when they're in sort of the, like, turning into hate phase, like,
yeah.
One of them will kind of try to, like, trick the other one for a second.
Yeah.
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 Well, one thing, I love the Philadelphia story, but one of the things I've always loved most about it is, like, you go in with a dude, Cary Grant, who understands exactly what's wrong with Katharine Hepburn. But it's only when it comes from Jimmy Stewart's mouth that she really hears it and is able to, like,
yeah.
let it hit her. And I feel like it is hard in some of these things, like, that are really trying to grab hold of all of that energy. Like, to me, the War of the Roses has always felt a little bit out of gear, or like something like Intolerable Cruelty, which went in
because it's mean. It's way too mean.
Yeah,
it's very evil.
And it always felt like the sweetness was a little sort of like over. It never felt real between Katharine Hepburn and Michael Douglas. Mrs. Doubtfire is a really, really interesting, like, iteration of this, because in this movie with such gigantic fantasy, the
yeah.
notion that this guy is putting on that outfit every day
right.
and going in there, when I watched it for the first time, I was like, fuck you, movie. Let him and Sally Field get back together. Why can't they get back together? And as time has gone on, I've realized that what a smart movie that is
right.
to say that we have a magical happy ending that is not your parents get back together, because, you know, are none of us the children of divorce?
No, but I grew up with lots of friends who had divorced parents.
See,
yeah.
And for me, what's interesting is that my first exposure to divorce was through pop culture, because I didn't know anyone who was either divorced or the children of divorced people until I was much older. And so when Kramer – and I don't think I actually watched Kramer versus Kramer, but the fact that it dealt with the topic was sort of my introduction to the very concept of divorce.
Well, it was kind of a hot topic when we were younger, because it was, you know, we sort of had the liberalization of divorce laws in the
right.
60s and 70s,
right.
and it was opening – no-fault divorce was raising the possibility of having a divorce that wasn't about one of your parents is fucking around or something like that. And, like, I do think that it is an interesting model. It was our first exposure to alternative family structures.
Mm.
Like – you know, when you think about The Odd Couple, like when you think about something like Kate and Ally,
mm-hmm.
which was a really interesting – my mom wouldn't let me watch Kate and Ally.
What?
Because
wow.
they were divorced. And it was sort of showing that –
that's shocking. Did she think was so bad about that?
She was just like – she thought that there was something – well, I think she just didn't like the CBS Wednesday night overall or whatever it was.
But, she objected to the lineup at large. Okay, I get it.
She kind of, I think, felt that it was too much lionizing the idea of these women – you know, leaving a good dentist husband who will provide for you just because you have gotten pissed off at him. And that show doesn't hold up. It's kind of bad. But it was something really beautiful at the time of saying these two women can support each other and make a home together and nothing's being lost. Those children are being parented well.
Well, there's a common thread, too, of women after divorce finding themselves. I mean, that's the other movie trope that exists out there.
Do you feel like the story of divorce is one that is gendered female, because the notion is dad just goes off and finds a 22-year-old, but what's this woman going to do?
Well, I do think it reflects the fact that marriage for women, I mean, not recently, but historically, has been a much more financially dependent situation for them. They were relying on the man's income.
Margaret Wappler, you get in a time machine, go back to 1969, and you try getting a credit card without David's approval. That's not going to go too well.
That's right. As it should. So, I mean, you know, I was thinking about the movie Desperately Seeking Susan, where, like, you know, the whole thing is her kind of Rosanna Arquette, her character, like, just kind of going off with Madonna, who represents this, like, ultra single, free living, you know, just like wild light that she follows,
mm-hmm.
and gets away from her husband, gets away from, like, the trappings of domesticity. So I think that is a real kind of consistency with the divorce movie,
Aiden
too.
Quinn.
Yeah.
I think the early wave of divorce-centric films tended to focus on women for exactly the reasons why Margaret pointed out. And I think there have been more films that have centered more on men or balanced it out. But I think it's tricky. Like, I was thinking of one of the films that you put on your list here, Guy, which is Crazy Stupid Love with Carell and Julianne Moore and what's his name? You know, heartthrob dude. And Emma Roberts.
Ryan
right.
Gosling?
Gosling, thank
yeah.
you.
Gosling.
And in the way that Carell's character gets centered, it's only because he has to kind of like rediscover his mojo and sort of claim this toxic masculinity, which he later rejects. But that's the only way that you could center him, because making a film that's about like a divorced guy in and of itself doesn't seem that compelling, unlike a divorced woman, because they've always been seen as more of the underdog. That's a built-in narrative right there.
Margaret, talk a little bit about Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage and it integrating divorce as a part of marriage.
So I don't know. Have you seen Scenes from a Marriage?
No.
It's epic. It's like 5 or 6 hours. It follows one couple through many, many manifestations of their relationship. And it's with Liv Ullmann. It's the Swedish TV series from 1973. It's Ingmar Bergman is the director. At any rate, you see them together, married in the beginning. Then you see them get divorced. Then you see them kind of go through the iterations of coping with that divorce and who has a new lover and who doesn't. And then at the very end, there's a kind of reconciliation, but not really. And it's just a beautifully done production because it really is uber realistic. In fact, it was so realistic that it really kind of scared Sweden when it came out. You know, there was a spike in Scandinavian divorce rates as soon as this came out. And so it really like affected people. And I actually, I'm a person who has gotten a divorce. I got divorced in my late 20s. And I watched this really soon after that divorce. And it just was like a really cathartic experience. Like, I can't even explain how cathartic, because you watch it and you're like, yep, this is how it feels to go through all of these feelings up, down, and all around.
You guys, I brought up this topic because Christian and I need to tell you that we are separating. and that it's not because of you guys. But if you had been more cooperative, it probably would have been easier for us to make this work.
That's right.
So, you know, it's going to be every other weekend at Christian's.
It's because I didn't do my chores, right?
It is. All right.
Two Hanukkahs, though.
We'll be right back with our jams right after this.
Hi, I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Riley Smurl. And we co-host a podcast called Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
On our show, we tackle all of the hot teen topics that kids have on their minds today.
Hot teen topics?
Well, you know, the questions that are plaguing teenagers through their tumultuous growing years. Questions like,
how do I party?
Or what do I do with all this hair everywhere?
The same questions that people like Sydney had during their years as teenagers. Many, many, many.
Okay, not that many.
So long ago.
Yeah, okay, I think they get the idea. So search for Still Buffering on iTunes or MaximumFun.org for new episodes every Tuesday. Still Buffering.
I am a teenager.
And I was too. Over and over again. Over and over again.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, what is your current jam?
Keeping with the theme, my current jam is Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E. And this song captures the feeling about divorce in its time. And that is basically that you couldn't even say it around the kids. You know, that it was such a loaded topic, that it was such a third rail that you wouldn't want to say it, so you'd spell it out. So let's hear a bit of that.
Our little boy is 4 years old and quite a little man. So we spell out the word.
We're not going to get to a D-I-V-O-R-C-E. God, Christian, you're cruel.
No wonder you guys are breaking up. I see the tension.
One of the things that always got me about that song was the way that a sadness underscored it. That there was always a sense that this woman had not done her job.
Like, if we had her voice is so broken, it's like, it's my fault. She's got that country music lady, like, it was my fault.
But it is also, you know, I mean, what's so wonderful about that song is the place it holds in kind of the, like, that Tammy Wynette and her place in the history of Hillary Clinton. That, like, you know, that the standing by my man like Tammy Wynette You know, and the first thing that, like, I remember pop culture snapping back with was Tammy Wynette also wrote D-I-V-O-R-C.
That's right. Answer back to that one.
Oliver, what's your jam?
So I stayed on the divorce theme, and I picked out Nas's Bye Baby, which is about his divorce from Khalees.
7 months in your pregnancy, about to have my seed. Let's take it back some years, rewind it to the happy years. You and your Star Trek fam, I'm thinking you cats are weird. Same time, different, yeah. I was digging y'all flow. Then I tatted you on my arm, so this would know. I thought no one could stop us. Magic gold watches, I was your Johnny Depp. You was my Janis Joplin, yet the cute version. Yet I knew your personally.
So divorce is really, I mean, breakups enter into hip-hop quite a bit, and usually it's some fictionalized fuck that bitch kind of, you know, song. This is one of the very few cases I can think of where a rapper has really talked about his own life, and specifically, and I mean, I guess it's maybe not that different from Kanye talking about like his ex-girlfriends, which he seems to do in every single song these days. But I mean, this was very raw, especially when it came out, because Nas and Khalees were such a public couple because they were both celebrities and artists in their own right. For them to sort of fall apart, and Nas turned his whole album really into some, you know, some different theme. Each song and even the album cover itself engaged his breakup from Khalees. So this was very personal for him and really just putting it out there. And I think, again, in the years since that happened, this is probably about 10 years ago at this point, we've gotten used to that more because of the whole kind of revolution with emo rap and Drake and whoever else. The idea that you would lay your bare soul, like lay your soul bare like this, is less uncommon. But I think when Nas was doing it, when Bye Baby came out, it was sort of like, wow, he is really getting into it right here.
Winner, what is your current jam?
Mine is kind of still around this theme, but it's called FML, which by Kanye from The Life of Pablo, which it's whatever. it's just whatever. But I like this song, and this song, instead of it standing for fuck my life, it's for my lady. And it's basically Kanye talking about how he tries to stay faithful to Kim and his commitment to being Kimye.
My soul lays to my soul. Revealing the layers of my soul. I wish I would go ahead and fuck my life up. Can't let them get to me. And even though I always fuck my life up.
Sidebar, I want to love this album, but it's so all over the place. And there's like two tracks I can even be down for.
And what's crazy is that he has been tinkering with it, and so that he just re-released the album now for sale, because previously it was just on streaming on Tidal. Now he's selling it through his website, and the songs have, I mean, people have done a very good job of accounting for exactly what's changed. In some cases, it's like they thickened the bass line on track 14. But he has made these little tinkers so that the first version we heard, I don't know, a month ago, is now kind of like the beta version. And now what he's selling is supposed to be, who knows if it's going to be the, he might make another change to it, but now there's sort of a 2.0 version of the album.
Now I just don't care.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That is possibly.
When the Hamburger Helper mixtape is hotter than your shit.
Oh,
that's really funny.
Ouch.
Shots fired.
All right.
Pew, pew, pew.
My jam is in no way related to divorce. It is related to the greatest battle to ever take place in gay public discourse, which, of course, went down at the 1984 Tony Awards, where we do all of our big events. I've been listening to a lot of Jerry Herman. What happened was, that was the year that Sondheim wrote Sunday in the Park with George, and it was revolutionary. It was genius. He had done a weird pointillist score to try to do a weird story about pointillist, quantilist or whatever, artist George Surratt. And everybody was saying, this is genius. This is fucking Sondheim, who we've been saying is a genius for 14 years now. Jerry Herman is a hoofer. Jerry Herman is like, he's not an actual dancer, but as songwriters go, this guy's workmanlike. He gave us Hello Dolly. He gave us Maine. He made good musicals. And he,
I like how you wagged your finger with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he, this year, 1984, had written La Caja Fall, the Broadway musical that is the same story as The Birdcage, but it was really kind of the first explicitly gay musical we ever saw on Broadway. And so you had these two titanic faggots with two very different approaches to things. Sondheim, who's never come out of the closet, who's astoundingly cerebral and astoundingly complex, but everything is hidden and everything is seen through, like, is so much more complex because he's never directly addressing everything, with this guy who kind of just, like, puts it all out there and writes a faggy song for you. And I had never, ever truly, truly loved this song, I Am What I Am, from La Caja Fall. And this past week, this song that is was probably to me distasteful because it is so obvious, because it is so out there, the true power of it hit me. And what happened at the Tonys was Jerry Herman fucking won. He got up there and he famously said, "Well, the rumor's not true. People have been saying that the simple, hummable tune is dead on Broadway, and we learned it isn't true," which was just talking shit at Sondheim. It was just him being a bitch at Sondheim. And please, please, Christian, play us a little.
I don't want praise, I don't want pity. I bang my own drum, something it's noise, I think it's pretty. And so what if I love each feather and each spangle? Why not try to see things from a different angle?
I'm sorry. However 1970s taffeta goofy that is, that motherfucker writing "your life is a goddamn sham" until you can say "I am what I am." And the line, that line, "I am what I am," was written in the book by the much more political Harvey Fierstein.
Right.
And Jerry Herman, you know, not a guy who thanks his lover at the Tonys, he picked it up and he turned it into a song. But that's a baller fucking move, and I insist the greatest diss track in the history of homosexuality. You have been listening to Pop Rocket with me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wathler, and Oliver Wang. We post our show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and you can also find links in the episode description on this podcast. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to Honkey, Trackinator 1.
Honkey!
Starship Enterprise, Humboldt, and Eric Says So for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. We got 4 reviews. Guys, good job last week that you got 4 reviews out of them. That's solid work.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join us in the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the very colorful Christian Duenas and Colin Anderson in absentia.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.